Ladies and gentlemen, our panelists, Alan Patrikov, Sonal Shah, Hubertus van der Vaart, and our moderator, James Surowiecki. Ladies and gentlemen, our working group chair, Gail Smith.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to what's going to be a great panel, because it's going to get to the heart of the matter and focus on financing. How do we really generate and provide the capital to back some of the terrific ideas that have been born in this room over the last couple of days? Before we get started with the panel, however, I'd like to ask a very good friend of CGI to speak to us for just a few minutes. At our opening lunch on Wednesday, I said that CGI is fortunate to have a lot of support and a lot of smart support. City has given us a lot of smart support. Their entire team has been engaged with us throughout, so it is my pleasure to introduce to you Luke Hayden of City.
Thank you, Gail. It's my pleasure to be with all of you this morning and to express City's pleasure at being the sponsor of the poverty alleviation part of the Clinton Global Initiative. We've done this for some years, and we're very proud to be associated with it as it grows and succeeds and generates a good deal of activity around the world on this subject. People sometimes ask, why does City care about global poverty? And I would have thought the answer was obvious, but I thought I'd take a minute to try to answer it. We care both on moral and practical grounds. On moral grounds, I don't think any of us can be comfortable with our own condition or that of our colleagues or our company if half the world is living on less than $2 a day and 10 million children are dying every year from diseases that we know how to prevent. But we also care for very practical reasons. Our future lies in growing our franchise in the fastest growing emerging markets around the world. And we know from our own experience that our ability to realize that aspiration depends on working with the civic community and with NGOs and with the governments and private sector in each of those countries to attack their own problems of poverty alleviation. Because reducing poverty, bringing people out of poverty and into economic opportunity has to mean that there will be millions more customers in addition to the 200 million customers that Citi now has in 106 countries around the world. So that's a simple reason for caring. What are we doing about it? Well, the most important thing, I think, is our sponsorship of this part of the Clinton Global Initiative. And we're very pleased to do that, as I said. But that's only the beginning. We believe we're one of the important forces in the world in microfinance. We have active microfinance programs in more than 30 countries around the world. Our approach to it on the philanthropic side is to be incubators and supporters of the intermediary organizations that make microfinance work, that link up financial institutions like ourselves and capital markets on the one hand with the recipients of microfinance loans on the other hand. For the most part, women who with loans that average $60 or $70 can become entrepreneurs and in many cases can go from becoming self-sufficient themselves to employing other people, to becoming small businesses in their own community. And one of our new initiatives is to take our microfinance activities and raise it a level to help those small enterprises that have gone from a single individual to employing 8 or 10 or 15 people in the community in which they live and work. That's something we're going to be announcing some new commitments on in the coming weeks and months. So we take a lot of pride about the role we've played in some intermediary microfinance organizations that you've probably heard about, like Grameen and BRAC and Compart Tamos and 20 or 30 others like that around the world. And we have big plans to expand that number in the coming period of time. We're also very proud of Volunteer Day. Once a year, we encourage our 400,000 employees to participate in the lives of their community in those 106 countries throughout the year. But once a year, we get a fair number of them to do something on a single day as a demonstration of the importance of civic involvement. Last year, it was a Saturday in November. We had just about 50,000 volunteers out there. I happened to be in Beijing the day before. And so on that Saturday, I went to a village about a couple of hours north of Beijing. I taught a class to microfinance loan officers in credit. Fortunately, the students knew a fair amount about credit before they encountered me. And then I participated with a couple hundred of my colleagues in picking scallions on a farm. Scallion growing and picking was the only productive enterprise in that village. This year we hope to have a good deal more than 50,000. And also, although it's related to the poverty alleviation part of this program, it's also directly related to the climate environment part. We're quite proud of a commitment we announced a couple of months ago that over the course of the next period of time, 8 or 10 years, we intend to invest and lend more than $50 billion in different ways to support efforts in climate change, new technologies, alternative energies, and the like around the world. So we're doing that, as I say, not only because it is the right thing to do, but because it's a sensible and practical thing for an enterprise like ours to do. And it all is accelerated, is pushed forward by the efforts and programs of the Clinton Global Initiative. So I'll end with the thought I started with. We are very pleased to be associated with this organization and this program. We expect to do it for many years to come. You have a terrific panel here to address the question of financing efforts to alleviate poverty, and I hope you have a good discussion with them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now we'll get started with a terrific panel. And again, as we've done before, we'd like to ask you to concentrate on a couple things as we move into this panel. And first, if you have questions, please write them on the cards that are available, or if they're not available, pass a note to your table facilitator, and we'll process those. And again, we're trying to focus on solutions and ideas. The topic of this conversation is one that has been consistent and persistent in CGI's deliberations on poverty since the start. And the further we can move this down the road towards solutions, the greater chance we can work with CGI members to step up to the plate and try to make some of your ideas and our panelists' ideas happen. So with that, James, I'll turn it over to you and have a very good time.
Great. Thanks. In The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith has a line. There's a section on it where he's talking about the entrepreneur, and he imagines an entrepreneur who has what he says, all the knowledge that is necessary to be a great merchant. And the only thing that hinders him from becoming a great merchant is the want of sufficient capital. And so I think that's really what we're going to be talking about today, how do we get the capital to the right kinds of people. And specifically what we're going to be talking about is how do we get capital to people who are going to start or who have already tried to start small and medium-sized enterprises rather than the sort of low-level entrepreneurs who do microfinance. So obviously microfinance is clearly, at least in the last few years, arguably the sort of hottest area, the area in which there's been the most interest when it comes to thinking about poverty alleviation. But for all the great work that microfinance does, it's difficult, I think, and we'll talk about this now, but difficult to make the case that microfinance really holds the key to poverty alleviation. And certainly next to impossible to make the case that it holds the key to long-term economic growth. The reality is that it seems like small and medium enterprises are a consistent characteristic of strong economies. So a recent World Bank study found that there was a very strong correlation between the percentage of small and medium enterprises in a country and its economic growth. Now, there wasn't proof that the one caused the other, but certainly there's a very strong correlation between the two. And in, for instance, OECD countries, small to medium-sized enterprises are responsible for something like 60 to 70% of net job creation. So arguably, without them, it is very, very difficult to sustain economic growth, sustain sustain productivity growth. And the reality of most developing countries is that their economies are divided between very, very large enterprises and very, very small enterprises. And so the middle ground, which is what we're going to be talking about today, is really where there is a true financing gap. And what we want to talk about is, why does that exist? What are the challenges we face in trying to fix it? And then what are the possible solutions? And we'll also talk about some good stories, some stories of how that gap has already been closed in certain places. But let's start with Alan Patrickoff. Alan, you have a tremendous amount of experience with financing companies of various kinds, and you also have a tremendous amount of experience thinking about and working on the problem of closing the financing gap with SMEs in Africa. So what do you view as the biggest challenge, and then what do you view as, I guess I'll just throw you the broad question, what do you think the solution is, if there is one? It's on, yeah.
Hello? Thank you. First of all, I want to say I'm truly excited to be here today because I think it's an indication that the dialogue has really shifted. 2 years ago when CGI was held, the conversation was all about microfinance. It was mostly about microfinance last year. And today, when Gail set this whole panel up, the intention was to let's take it to the next step and focus on those kinds of businesses and their requirements for financing that are at the next level, who really could be the job creators, the significant job multipliers of the future. I come to this from a background of almost 40 years in the venture capital business, and in the last 5 years, I've spent a lot of time all over the developing world and principally in Africa. And I have come to see what the great need is in the young entrepreneurial business. We heard Ian Davis the other day from McKinsey first not criticize, but play down the word of entrepreneurship. And by the time he finished in his second remarks, he came back and said, no, that wasn't what his intention was. He was thinking about entrepreneurship on a small level, saying there's a lot of it, but we need people who think about scaling up businesses. And I think that is, without any question, the greatest need in the developing world. Switch yourself and think of yourself as a young man or woman who's been told by every NGO, by their parents, who've suffered and done everything they can to send them to school and then send them, where possible, to university and then to graduate school and in some cases to go to the United States or Europe and to learn the skills in a business school or an engineering school or a professional school and get the talent, managerial and otherwise educational, to do something big and take their lifestyle a great step forward. And they come back to Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Mozambique, and they immediately meet the frustration of how do I become an entrepreneur? All I heard about was entrepreneurism. I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to build a business of scale. I don't want to just have a local shop. I want to do something that is going to think like Bill Gates did, like Steve Jobs did, like Fred Smith did at Federal Express, I can't remember the name from Staples, all of which started as small businesses, but they thought big right from the beginning about being a huge company over a long period of time. And they hit immediately the challenge, which is consistent whether you're in Bulgaria, Botswana, or Bangladesh, is that nobody wants to give you equity capital. It just doesn't exist in the world. Now, obviously, there's always an exception, but it's very, very difficult to come by. If you can get money, and it's very hard to get, it will be borrowed money. If you can get any borrowed money, you'd have to secure it with almost every asset you have. You pay a high interest, a short amortization period, and you immediately say, you know, to yourself, can I take those kind of risks and build a future? So what you do is you think smaller. And I consistently have seen in the developing world people who could be much bigger in their thinking, but who think small for survival. Now, I've been in the venture business for almost 40 years. I have backed hundreds of companies. I have never, never backed a company that's anything other than equity. I have been in the venture industry. I've never seen a company backed in the venture industry with anything other than equity. Now, think about that. The reason is that people who start these businesses take risks, but if they fail, they come back again, they keep all their assets, they've learned something in the process, and hopefully a lot of them don't lose everything, and they succeed, as some of the ones I mentioned to you. When you go to the developing world, you find that there is virtually an absence of equity. Bert will tell you their organization does some, and there are a few others, but there really is very little. What exists, first of all, people confuse microfinance with SMEs. That doesn't make it. Then you have the organizations with the banks who say, we don't do cash flow lending, we only do secured lending. So you're up against this challenge. I've been to many, many universities, and I've spoken to graduates here and abroad and in the African clubs, and say, and around the room of 15, 20, 40 people, how many of you are going back to Africa? Almost always, nobody raises their hand. Not saying half of them, almost no one. And when you find out, they're all going to work for Goldman Sachs, Credit Suisse, First Boston, because they make a lot of money. And the other reason they give is it's too difficult because I can't get finance to carry out my ideas. So what I've focused on, and what I'm very anxious to proselytize, is to get the development finance organizations, to get the philanthropic organizations who are thinking this way, like Google, to think about the fact that we built an entrepreneurial society in the developed world based on risk-taking, which we encourage, based on an equity base, and yet we expect that same kind of entrepreneurial activity in the developing world, and yet nobody wants to make the appropriate kind of capital structures that enables people to build businesses. I want to see in the next 10 years businesses built in many of the developing countries. Every one of them has talented entrepreneurs that are as good as Steve Jobs, as good as Fred Smith. They're there, men and women. They want to start businesses. They want to grow their small business to something big, and yet they're faced always with this inappropriate capital structure that doesn't allow them to do the kind of growth, to put the capital investment in to build world-class companies, to put the money in to build marketing structures, to do something appropriately with the right environmental issues of concern, the right labor standards, all the things they want to do. So what they do alternatively is they stay in the informal market, they think small, and they get frustrated, and they go to work for big companies abroad. Now, there are also many people like that.
I just want to say, why do you think that doesn't exist? I mean, why is the capital structure set up the way it is? I mean, if it's such an opportunity, and even it's obviously it's not necessarily the kind of opportunity it represents to a Western investor is probably a little different from the opportunity it represents to an investor in the country in those countries. But if it has the possibility of forget becoming FedEx, even if it has the possibility of becoming a very substantial enterprise, why are those capital structures sort of not in place? Or what do you think the biggest challenges are in terms of getting them in place?
I think capital is hard to come by. A lot of the structures that we're talking about are also Western-funded institutions.
Right.
What's there are banks. And the banks have a hard time because it's cheaper for them to lend into the government and get a return than it is actually to take risks on entrepreneurs who they don't know or who don't have collateral, or property rights is a big issue. They don't have anything to collateralize with. So what happens in general is they tend to take the safe bet, and the safe bets are today now investing in microfinance institutions,
right,
or they take the safe bet of investing in large businesses. Very few actually are willing to go down that chain. And those risk management structures are not put in place in banks. And we need to figure out, I agree with Alan, I think equity is a huge thing. On the development institution side, you know, failure is not okay in the development institutions. Nobody wants to talk about it. And nobody wants to say, oh, we invested in 10 companies, 5 failed, 3 succeeded, 2 kind of did okay. What works with venture capital is we're okay with failure. We're okay testing 10 businesses and maybe having 3 go really big,
right,
and 7 do all right, maybe 1 fails. But we're not okay in the development institution side to try that and to try those risks and take those risks.
So that's why we like with microfinance that you hear like 95% repayment or something like that. Basically,
absolutely.
That's a much easier
98, 99.
Right, that's a much easier thing to sell. Right,
that's in there that allows people to pay back on a regular basis.
But it's also like it's an easier story to tell than Four of our companies really hit, and
right,
6 did okay or whatever.
So microfinance are lending to cash-generating businesses,
right,
who probably turn their capital over every day or certainly every week.
Right. Right.
I just had a couple more things.
Sure.
I think equity is an important aspect of this, and I think it's certainly a huge aspect that would be nice to have some risk capital in there. But I also think we have to look at the whole financial system and think about how we can take risks throughout the financial system, whether it's working with banks in developing countries or international banks and thinking about how they might take a little bit more risk, thinking about distribution models and how those distribution models might change, finance distribution models, other distribution models. We've got to look at the whole financial system and then figure out where can we leverage risk capital, where can we put in risk capital, try things that sometimes might fail, but it's okay, it's worth the test, and then try different ways of doing it.
Well, you're at Google now, google.org. I mean, what are you going to do? What do you want to do?
Of course. Of course, that's a great question, which I hope it's not going into the press anytime soon. I think we're going to look at the whole chain. We're going to look at equity funds like Allen's. We're going to work with partners like TechnoServe, who are doing kind of the business technical assistance training, because also that's important. We're going to look at banks. We're talking to ICICI, Citi, and others, and thinking about how we can create risk distribution models with them and what are some things. We're also looking at alternative financial instruments, so risk insurance instruments as well as other things. So we're looking at the whole system and thinking about where might we play a role and where are people not willing to take the risk that we're willing to put in.
Okay. Now, so we've heard a lot about the challenges. Let's hear a little bit from Bert about successes, or at least, you know, someone who's able to make this work, who actually has been putting money into SMEs in the developing world for many years now.
Thank you. I'd like to certainly commend the panel, as Alan said, to even be able to address SME. One of our advisory council people said loving an SME is like loving a tractor. I mean, the microfinance is much easier. You have a woman with a colorful skirt in the market in La Paz. Everybody loves her. What's not to love? But, you know, an SME, all these guys, you know. And I think, unfortunately, what we have to understand is that in private sector development and growth, you got to deal with people with tractors. You got to deal with that kind of person who you probably wouldn't want to have, you know, your daughter marry. I mean, quite honestly. But that's where the driving force is in very difficult environments. We're now in 25 countries, Uzbekistan, Macedonia, Afghanistan, as well as Western China, India, all Central Europe, Peru, Colombia, etc. I would say that over 18 years of our existence, we've raised $500 million. Now, $500 million sounds like a lot of money, or it doesn't sound like money. I think Alan does a deal in $500 million. But, you know, it's what we found in this is, and I think we're trying to address today, is what's the supply and demand? You know, it's clear from the entrepreneur he wants risk capital. It's clear he doesn't want to have banks or whatever else leeching money that he thinks he can reinvest and do better with. He needs that buffer to make that productivity happen. And this is critical. This is what I think the comments you said about micro is correct. It's very hard to increase value added. It's very hard to increase productivity if you're worried on a daily basis, am I clearing enough money to pay the loan off at 47% or whatever else it is, very, very high. What you need is you need some lead capital. You need some capital equipment in order to be able to increase productivity, get you at a higher level. You need some time. And one of the things that we've done a very exhaustive development impact study to try and understand what is going on at the SMEs. What we find out is the SMEs in the kind of countries that Alan is talking about do not hire the guys who go to Harvard Business School. They do not hire the people. Who hires them is the NGOs. They pay a hell of a lot better, and they're a lot less risky to work for. You know, and if you're in a difficult country and you've got an education, you do not want to be seen as failing. You know, and I think that's a big, big issue. So who do we hire? We hire people who don't have high school education. And the interesting thing is there's a book by William Lewis on the power of productivity. I don't know if people have read that. Interesting thing is you can train people without high school education to be among the world's top in the productivity side. But you've got to be incentivized to train them. You've got to hold them on. And I tell you, one of the things that happens, 87% of the employees that are hired by our SMEs are unskilled. They're all trained. The training is phenomenal. That's probably the biggest thing. It's not just jobs they create. It's jobs plus training, training on the job kind of training. Six color press, how do I operate that? Bookkeeping, how do I operate that? You know, these are how to get piglets out of sows if I'm in a pig farm. You know, that becomes valuable. And when these guys become valuable, guess what? They get paid more. So there's a 26% annual increase in the average wages that our SMEs pay to employees. Now, why is that growth important? That growth is important because you can then actually get a mortgage. You can actually send your kids to school. You can actually have a life. Most people would prefer to have a life. Most 99% of the people would prefer to say, there's a chance that I can take a vacation. There's health insurance I've got. Micro is very tough, and I think Sonal is correct. If you can do disability insurance, if you can do things which alleviate some of the worst problems of that abyss. But as a result, if you're worried about having your only assets taken away or being thrown out on the street, you're not going to take a lot of risk. You're not really going to do a lot of value added. And I think that's fundamentally, if we want poverty to be alleviated, we need to have growth. How to get that growth is you got to work with the entrepreneurs. You got to grow their financial strength so they can access banks. I'm not saying there's nothing wrong with debt. That's good. But debt without some buffer, without some equity, is not going to work. Secondly, if you're partnering with these people, you need, and this is why we do equity. We backed into equity. We were originally from CARE. CARE lost their shirt in microfinance. And the only thing we saw is, well, you know, we got to actually help these entrepreneurs scale up. We got to help them understand what the world economy is doing to them. Globalization, most countries are much more dynamic than Bangladesh, and I can talk about that in another part. But the whole idea is if you're in a very dynamic country and you're doing something and you don't understand how the business is moving and you're just worried about making the payment on that loan, guess what? A multinational is going to move 50 kilometers away from you. They're going to get their product on the shelf space. You're going to be toast. And so if you don't have a partner who is able to try to broker what's going on, if you don't have a way of saying, how do I grow value, then that's a real problem. The other thing I would say is formality. Formality. In the developing world, a lot of our backers, investors, have not really focused on the need for countries to have a tax base. Multinationals find a way not to pay taxes. I was a lawyer before I did this. I can tell you lots of ways not to pay taxes if you're a multinational. Micros don't pay taxes either because who the heck can chase these guys down? I mean, they're basically in the market and they're up back in the hills or whatever. Where the SMEs are, the big misfortune of SMEs is they're locatable. And as a result, you know, governments everywhere shake them down. You know, and these are the people who pay taxes.
So that's why people prefer to stay in the informal sector then.
In many countries like Bolivia, you are much better off. We backed a lady doing noodles. We're going to the formal side. We started paying effective taxes, including Social Security, 87%. We could not compete.
The effective tax they were paying was 87%.
And therefore, our margins, we were not able to compete in Bolivia, and we were able to sell to reform houses in the health storehouses in Germany, into Norway, into Canada. There's something seriously wrong when, you know, your competition doesn't have to pay all that variety.
Right.
And so as a result, there's an incentive to not grow. There's an incentive to stay down, not understand what your costs are, not pay your employees fairly. So those are kinds of the perverse incentives that happen if they're, in this case, it's an over microfinanced company.
Right.
Country.
Okay, can I interrupt here?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sitting here listening, and Alan's talking about guys who have a chance to work for Goldman Sachs and instead are supposed to go work for some,
yeah,
start their own business where they don't know where they're going to get the money and they have a chance of losing their shirt.
Right.
And Sonal's talking about rearranging the entire financial system, the way we think about it throughout the system as a whole. And you're saying we need to reform government and have a better tax system and better property rights and a formal sector. And
well,
so I'm sitting here sounding this sounds like a really hard thing to do.
The real objective I have is to build role models.
Yeah.
Role models make such a difference. Can you imagine what Richard Branson make you?
Right.
Think of how many times Steve Jobs' name is mentioned. I've mentioned him four times already.
Right.
But it right away signifies he can do it, I can do
right.
it. And when you go to the developing world, there are so few role models, and that is because they don't get the opportunity. And these role models build real companies that have corporate governance, that pay taxes, that have good accounting. You know, when I first went over to Africa with the IFC, Harold Rosen sitting here from the IFC, I remember once someone saying we have three taxes. We have three sets of books. And another guy at the same table said, no, it's four sets of books. You know, one for the government, one for my shareholders, one for my employees, and one for my wife.
Right. Right.
I thought that was always very funny. Linda Rottenberg sitting in front from Endeavor. Endeavor is about what I'm about, which is find the best of the best in the developing world and give them all the help you can get, start them with good structural financial structures, give them reinforcement from technical assistance if they need it. And I don't want you to get confused. I'm not just talking about people who've been in going to the Harvard Business School and come back. I'm talking about local people who've gone to Lagos Business School, Kenya Business School. But people, I'm saying people who've been trained, and they are high school people who've got they've got the moxie to do something, and they want to do it the right way. We've got to find a way to help them, and that we've got to educate the banks. And frankly, a lot of these banks who won't lend, if there was an equity base, and it's what Bert's saying, and the right kind of capital structure, there'd be an equity base underneath their loans. You could loan on a more reasonable, realistic basis because you had a cushion of the equity investor.
Right. So, Sonal, yeah, go ahead. You look.
It's happening. I mean, I think in some ways it seems like such a big problem. Who's doing it? What's not happening? I mean, Ndithi's here, and she's been working in Nigeria, and they're already setting up funds. They're already investing in SMEs. I think, if anything, if everyone walks away with something from here, is that there are entrepreneurs out there. There are people that are already taking those risks. We need to go find them. We need to go invest in them. We need to be willing to take that little bit of a risk ourselves. I think from a Western perspective, we just get a little bit scared about taking our own risk. So we'll put in some risk capital with a lot of caveats. And let's not put in all the caveats, because we're operating in a developed financial system. We're going into developing country financial systems. Be willing to take a little bit more risk capital. Be willing to lose a little bit more, because they're out there and they need the support. But if we sit here and keep talking about it, next year we'll be back and be like, wouldn't it be great if we were investing in SMEs? It would be great if we were actually coming back and saying, we've invested in these and here are some great lessons learned and we should do more of it.
Yeah, and the only thing I would say, these role models, the demonstration impact, this is one of the difficult things about equity in SMEs, is it takes a long time to go full cycle.
Right.
The nice thing about a microfinance is 6 months payback or no.
Right.
You know? The problem with an SME fund, I mean, with the first one we structured in Poland, is a 15-year life, and it's only now we're getting some phenomenal successes. I mean, you know, 40 times money and incredible jobs growth, et cetera. But obviously, you have to hold that company for 10 years. Now, in the conventional model of venture capital, that's unheard of. People want a 3 to 5 year is even considered, you know, relatively long.
Right.
So now here's the issue. The IFIs, or people who are interested in backing that, they need to have a longer-term perspective. The one thing we can say is, you know, we have demonstrated that $8 million, $15 million funds have made money. They've gone, you know, two times. They've gone 11%, 15% kind of net IRRs. Not fantastic returns. And whoever says you can make as much money doing this, I think, as other things, I think you're wrong. I think you have to really, what you look at is, what are the other developmental impact criteria?
Right.
How can we hold people to account? Can we actually quantify some of the things we're looking for? And are there people who are willing to back these kind of funds who, if you're holding people to account and seeing what they achieve, in addition to what the returns are, would be satisfied? A lot of people say, oh, but Bert, we can't subsidize these funds in emerging markets. I mean,
right.
That's distorting the economy.
Right.
If you look at the U.S. economy with the SBA, or if you look at all the manifold CDFIs, all sorts of tax incentives for doing the same thing, there's no Western country that does not see the economic and the political importance of decentralized economic power through SMEs, and they subsidize them. And the real problem we have is, if you go to Africa, where you have to generate your own electricity, you've got to have your own security guards, you've got to teach your own people everything, because the state basically has failed. Now you're asked to do this on a non-subsidized basis, and you're going to be criticized because you're returning 6%.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy. So in that context, I think people just need to understand what they're comparing before. And the challenge to people out there is, can you come up with intelligent measurements holding people to account, which would, in a multivariable kind of utility function, give you what you really are interested in, instead of just saying, well, it's got to be 35%, because, hell, that's what venture capital in the U.S. returns.
So we're talking about the possibility for reasonable returns, but there's obviously a blend here between the goal of making money and the goal of doing good.
No one should be in this segment at this stage unless they accept a less than commercial rate.
Right.
Not that we don't want to get make lots of money, but I think if you kid someone and you tell them you're going to do this, I think you are misleading them. I think one should have lower return objectives, but on the other hand, some very, very positive. I mean, from my standpoint, if one could be in single-digit returns and at the end of 10 years say, I built companies as a fund, not me personally, I mean, a fund, built companies that are employing 10,000 people, wow, that would be some enormous accomplishment. And I think that's the challenge we've got. And the problem is that the development finance institutions, the DFIs, have this orientation of they've got to make 14% rates of return. Let me tell you something very interesting that people don't know. The venture capital industry in this country was financed by foundations. It was by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, the Whitney Foundation, the Phipps Foundation. They were the earliest people in venture who took chances after World War II, and that's where the big wave of development, of entrepreneurial development. And they're the organizations like Sonal's who are new into this area. There are lots of them, and they've got to think about this aspect in terms of their activities of generating this same kind of momentum in the developing world.
Okay. Now, when you talk about role models, you talk about demonstration effects and so on. I mean, part of what it seems like you're talking about is culture in some way, and culture in kind of the broadest sort of a culture of an economic culture in a way. I mean, to what degree is that part of the puzzle here, the question of sort of getting people to think about entrepreneurship in a certain kind of way, getting people to think about the willingness to give up part of their company to the whole idea of equity investment is not necessarily like an intuitive concept to most people.
Absolutely. Our best deal flow in countries where we are repeating are from people who've seen that we backed someone who's exited, made a lot of money, and tell people you can trust them. Obviously, if I'm coming from the U.S. and there's a Bulgarian on the other side, he's going to think, well, what kind of stuff am I talking about?
Right.
But if a Bulgarian has made money with me, then that's what happens. When people see a couple of people who succeeded by having, as you say, brought in third-party capital, by being willing to be transparent, by paying the taxes, by getting the all the wages on the books, and still succeed, I think that's enormous. And I think that's really one of the biggest issues. So there's a number of demonstrations. Like, one, can you back funds and get your money back? But two, can entrepreneurs in the country see that if they are willing to take third-party capital with the accountability that occurs and have the ambition to grow, that they can succeed? And I think that's critical in every country.
I think it also takes time. You've got to be willing to work with the entrepreneurs to come up with the deals. And I know where you've spent quite a bit. And it's not here where you come in and it's like, oh, that looks great. Let's work with them. They'll understand it. It takes maybe 10 to 20 to 40% more time than you might in the West to set up and in cost. Exactly. People in some of the funds that we're looking at, people are like, wow, that's the 5% where it's going to cost 5%. Well, 5% seems high until you realize how long it's going to take to get the entrepreneur to grow and to take the time to get there and the investment of individuals' time. So what a normal fund might do 30 deals, this fund might do 15 because it just takes longer to get there. But it's going to take time, and we've got to be willing to be okay with time too.
You asked about cultural issues. I'll tell you that the first word I came back with after a couple of years of going around that I kept hearing, nobody trusts each other.
Right.
Trust is absent in the developing world. If I don't know you or know your family for 30 years, it's hard for me to invest in someone and be a minority investor and accept protection. So what they do is that's why you have a lot of family type activities. And so if you think about it, imagine if we had to know the president of General Motors, the people running General Motors, and we didn't trust buying in our stock market or in the private companies that I do all the time here and have done for so many years. There's a certain degree of, setting up systems, legal systems. And the problem is not that the laws don't exist in these countries. The laws exist in a lot of them. They certainly have changed in the last 4 or 5 years. It's the enforcement of laws that people are concerned with. And listen, we know the problems. I mean, we haven't talked about problems. None of us are ignorant of them. No exits, the problems with infrastructure, problems with the legal system, but they're gradually being overcome, and the trust issue is going to be overcome over time when people see just what Bert says, you can be successful.
Well, there's one thing also, trusting, if I could just make a quick, because we've been looking at that in Africa in particular. In Africa, the mistrust is so high, and we are absolutely just thrilled to be able to announce a joint venture with Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who is just, she has an image of integrity that, and particularly women-led companies, which is what we're targeting in West Africa, would absolutely trust, and that kind of a role model, to bring that person into the small, medium enterprise kind of stuff, we're just thrilled about. So these are isolated issues where we've been trying to show that if you've got a politician who's been courageous enough to talk about this integrity, translating that into entrepreneurs who are going to trust you, et cetera, is something that really excites us about Africa. I think there are changes. Alan is right. People are seeing success. It's not just sell-tell. It's much more even at the lower level. So that's what I think gives people a lot of optimism about Africa. Other thing about culture, sometimes the instruments have to be, for example, in Afghanistan, we're doing Islamic leasing. It would be crazy for us to come up with arbitration in London for an SME in Kabul. I mean, using New York law. I mean, so you really have to try to find us what's going to be seen as something which gets you closer to the partnership, gets you closer to the trust, well, certainly speaking the language and introducing what your instrument is in a way that can be understood locally is one of those.
Okay. All right. We are about ready to wrap it up. I mean, one thing I'd like to talk about when we come back afterwards is maybe think a little bit more about what the role of the state in all this is and what actually governments can do. But now I'll hand it over to Gail.
You know, when I talked to our moderator and panelists beforehand, I said, you know, these things are usually best when you get a real conversation going. And it didn't seem that that was the least bit difficult with this this bunch. Thanks. That was really very helpful. And we want to, again, turn to you to think about and talk about solutions to some of the things that our panelists have talked about, the different sectors that governments can take as you just suggested, that businesses, that NGOs, that citizens can take. And I want to ask you to think about four things as you do that that we've heard about. One is about risks. What are some of the solutions that can be pursued that take into account, as Sonal says, that if you want to pursue development, you've got to be willing to take some risks. And how can that risk be spread out? Role models, the example of Ngozi. Alan, you've made this point also. How do we elevate the role models? How do we identify the role models? There are a lot of them out there. How do we shine a spotlight on that? How do we get people to understand that you've got to take a long-term perspective? This is not instant food. This is not going to McDonald's. This is investing and nurturing over time a company that can be transformative in a community, to a country, to an entire region. But it takes time to grow. How do we overcome that roadblock? And finally, at our tables around the room, we have a lot of small and medium entrepreneurs. We have some who started small and are now very large, huge entrepreneurs, if I can add another letter, SMEHs. We have a lot of people who would aspire to be entrepreneurs that are here with great ideas and have faced their own obstacles in getting into the mix. So I would like to encourage that at all tables, those of you with a great deal of experience in this area, put your views and ideas into the conversation as much as possible. Now, we started a bit late. The schedule for today has been adjusted a little bit, so we're going to have close to our usual time for this. We may tweak it at the end. But with that, I will ask you to get started. We'll come back to you in a bit. And our panel, we thank you again, and we'll hear from them again in a little while. Thank you.